Thank you for staying for our late night special. I started without you. It's minute after seven. I understand. A day with the Lord's 1,000 years, and 1,000 years is one day. I understand that. All right, purpose this presentation. We're targeting couples who want to make sure an affair is not a part of your future. If that's already taken place, that's another lecture for another time. We begin tonight by talking about the foundation for fidelity. Foundation for fidelity, some general observations. Lynn and I are believers what's called the cookie theory. The cookie theory simply says if the cookie is big enough and good enough, you'll take it, unless you're God-centered. We maintain that God-centeredness is the only basis for Christian morality. A movie came out a number of years ago. I didn't see it. I saw the previews. Maybe you saw the same previews. A man offered another man $1 million to sleep with his wife for one night. A friend of mine who is a top CEO said that was discussed in his office among secretaries, male and female, business managers, and so on. And someone said, no, I wouldn't do it. Well, one person said, well, could you do it? Apologize to your spouse, then spend $1 million together. Well, that's a possibility. Antioch, Tennessee. You be unfaithful to your spouse for $1 million. No way. I wouldn't even entertain the thought, okay? If you wouldn't do it for $1 million, would you do it for $1 billion? Now, see, was your answer is fast. Look out. We're going to have confession time down here in the front.
We are right here.
My question is your answer as quick on $1 billion as it was $1 million? Now, it might be like one place we did this conference, and after it was over, a lady came up to me. She said, when you offer my husband $1 billion, he leaned over and said, I'm still thinking about the million.
I bet he slept on the couch.
He slept on the couch that night.
I bet he did.
Now, the reason why you might do it, you say $1 billion? Yes. Tax-free? Yes. Boy, just think of all the missionaries we could support. Now, see, the reason you might do it might not have to do with money. Might have to do with emotional neediness or self-esteem or power, position, or prestige. We maintain that unfortunately, we have tried to get our young people especially be moral for wrong reasons. Three wrong reasons we have heard many times are detection, infection, or conception. Oh, I don't want to be immoral because of being detected. It's going to embarrass me or my family. I'm going to get some kind of disease, or I'm going to conceive of something for which I'm going to have to be responsible. Folks, there's not a biblical argument there. What happens if somebody assures you that nobody will know, we don't have any kind of disease, we can take precautions against conception? Your history is just a matter of time. Again, what we would be saying is, when David was sinned with Bathsheba, he said, God, God, against thee and thee only have I sinned. When Joseph was tempted to sin with Potiphar's wife, he said, how can I do this great sin against my God? Two passages of Scripture for your consideration tonight. The first one is found in 1 Thessalonians chapter 4. The name of God is mentioned 5 times in 8 verses. Verse 1, finally, brothers, we're instructed how you ought to live in order to please God. Verse 3, it's God's will that you should be sanctified, that you should avoid sexual immorality. Verse 5, not in the passionate lust like the heathen who do not know God. Verse 7, for God did not call us to be impure, but to live a holy life. Verse 8, therefore he rejects this instruction, does not reject man, but God who gives you the Holy Spirit. Paul does not argue detection, infection, or conception. He argues relationship with God. Same writer, different verse. 1 Corinthians chapter 6, verse 15. Do you not know that your bodies are members of Christ himself? Shall I take the members of Christ and unite them with a prostitute? No. Verse 18, flee from sexual immorality. All of the sins a man commits are outside his body, but who sins sexually sins against his own body. Do you not know that your body is the temple of the Holy Spirit, who is in you, whom you received from God? You're not your own. You're bought with a price. Therefore, honor God with your body. Succinctly said, you can't do with your body what you want to do because your body belongs to God. It's just that simple. You see, in order to be involved in sexual immorality or pornography, as we'll talk about on Tuesday night, you have to factor God out of the equation. Can you imagine two people out here getting ready to be immoral, some motel, and one of them says, you know, before we do this, let's pray together. I doubt seriously if that's going to be. However, we have dealt with people that felt very comfortable in immorality and felt they were closer to God than ever before. Obviously, it was a distortion. Causes and counters for infidelity. The root cause is selfishness. That's what the sermon was about this morning. Sin is the choice of self as the supreme object of service. So the umbrella of selfishness goes over all the causes that we're going to list for you tonight. The cause that we hear quite often is we grew apart. We grew apart. Ladies and gentlemen, I don't know how to say it, but I just say it. Many of us are just entirely too busy. We got too many balls in the air trying to spin too many different plates, and we don't have time for one another. We just don't take that time. When was the last time you as a family had a meal together? I mean, not three in the den and two in the kitchen. I'm talking about a meal together that you sat down at the same table and ate and talked and discussed. Long time. And you wonder why you've lost closeness. Our kids are involved probably, from my perspective, and you make your decision, probably involved in a whole lot more activities than they need to be. Why, if they don't play three sports, they're going to get warped. I'm not against sports. But you see, if by all this that it sacrifices the closeness and arrangement of a family, my question is, what kind of price are we paying for this? Now, I can't make that decision for your family, but I can ask you to at least think about it and consider it. Lynn's my best friend. I'm her best friend. How do you develop friendship? You spend time together. We were supposed to fly in here Friday night, but apparently you had a snowstorm around here Friday night, and they canceled all the planes. What's interesting, we were all packed, ready to go. Taxi was supposed to be there in 15 minutes. They called us and said, flight canceled. I called Josh and said, flight canceled. Can't get one out tonight. In many ways, I looked at Lynn, she looked at me, and both of us said, whoopee. You know what we did? We went out to eat, and I took her to a movie. We had a date night, Friday night. Because of your snowstorm.
By the way, The Commuter is a really good movie.
Yeah, we did see that.
And I don't say that about, but as far as a clean, good thriller, it is good. Pardon, go ahead.
Yeah.
I just want to, you know, you don't really get one very often. It's really good. So, it's good.
Yeah. Now, see, we spend time together. We believe every couple, you see, okay. Now, tomorrow, we don't do anything in connection with our seminar except tomorrow night. Yeah. Tomorrow is what we call Magnificent Monday. We're going to do something around your town. I don't know what it's going to be. But see, we're going to do some things together. Because you see, if we didn't keep our friendship going and we got a divorce, you might not ever want us to come back and do another conference.
Yeah. Be a little bit more.
Right. Now, we believe every couple needs to spend at least 30 minutes a day talking or sharing. You say, well, that doesn't sound like much. It might not sound like much, but it's probably more than what you're doing now, and you wonder why your relationship's going south. What do you do during those 30 minutes? Guys, I knew you were going to ask it. I'm not going to tell you.
But there is an agenda.
There is an agenda, and we're going to explain that on Wednesday night.
Another teaser.
Yeah. You better plan. We'll be here 4 or 5 hours on Wednesday night to get it all in. But there's an agenda. And see, that's the relationship. You talk about a legacy that you would want to leave for your children. One of the greatest legacies that you could leave for your children, you love their mother, you love their father. What a legacy you could use.
The second cause for infidelity is distorted thinking. Distorted thinking. Let me build on that. Sin distorts truth. Sin distorts reality. Some have said that sin occurs when we have a perceived need. Legitimate or not, that's not the issue. But Satan gives us an illicit way to fill it. Distorted thinking. Several years ago, we were in Arkansas, not conducting a conference format at that point, but, I mean, not getting married at that point, but conducting a conference. And by the way, all that stuff, I was kind of talking in the foyer, but what he usually says is true on Sunday night.
I usually say is true.
I mean,
what
about
I always say is
all
true.
All right. Yeah, it's true. Did you tell them, though, what happened?
You stick to the script.
Well, did you tell them what happened to the camouflage kimono?
I did not tell them what happened to the camouflage kimono because I didn't want to break their hearts. They were upset enough with what you did to the knife.
Would you like to know what happened to the camouflage kimono? It is.
No, you don't. I'm running this show. You need to be silent anyway. Go ahead.
In your dreams. All right. You asked for that one, sweetheart. Okay. It really did meet an untimely demise, I suppose. Now, keep in mind, we've been on the road 22 years now, and we fly all the time. We fly, you know, like, okay. And in all those years, we have only completely lost one piece of luggage. Now, occasionally they'll be late, they'll show up 2-3 days late, but as far as totally lost and never show up, only one time. And would you believe that the camouflage kimono was in that piece of luggage? And it was a direct flight from Orlando, Florida to Indianapolis, Indiana. And to this day, he says, he believes that I paid the sky cap to lose the luggage. Okay, back to the story. We were actually conducting a conference format. And we followed right on the heels of an issue at that church. The elders at that location determined that they would have a children's worship hour that would run concurrently with the adult worship hour on Sunday morning, probably very similar to what we witnessed here this morning. And I think they service children between the ages of 2 and 5 or 6, something like that. But that was long before the era, it was a long time ago, of the children's minister. And nothing like that. And so they asked 4 couples who were very creative to serve as coordinating couples for this children's worship hour. And they asked, they would take a quarter a year, these 4 couples. And each couple was to determine what they wanted to teach the children, actually write or obtain the lessons, and create or obtain the teaching tools. Well, we followed right after a quarter had been taught on Satan, on the devil. The coordinating couple decided they wanted to teach the little ones about the evil one, and they were very creative, and so they had written their own storylines, but they had also constructed their own teaching tools, and they had made the puppets with the big heads and the big mouths. Some of you are nodding. The children seemed to love them. But I guess they had done something a little bit incongruent when they had made the Satan puppet, because you see, he was the tallest and the largest puppet. And as those puppets go, he was the best looking puppet. And as the storylines played out, he was the most verbally fluent puppet, the most affluent puppet, the most socially acceptable puppet, the puppet with the best sense of humor. You get the picture. The puppet that all the other little puppets always wanted to be around. And then at each Bible hour, the Satan puppet would lead the other little puppets into doing bad things. And then, of course, they tried to explain to the children what had transpired. Well, some of the parents of the little ones had become quite distressed with this entire situation and had called this couple on the carpet, literally, in front of the church leadership with an accusation and a question. And the accusation was this: you deliberately deceived our children. And the question, why did you make doing bad look so good? And I thought they answered the only way they could have, at least from my perspective. They answered with another question. And they queried back, when are we going to stop or to start teaching our children that Satan is someone that runs around in with a red suit and horns and a pitchfork and a tail? When are we going to start teaching our children that sin really looks good, right? It doesn't show itself immediately. We don't call it the way it is. They need to see it for what it is. And I thought it was a good question or a good statement. That's the nature of the distortion, correct? Sin never looks as bad as it really does, if it looks bad at all to the person involved in it. Oh, I can call it in your life in a heartbeat. You can call it in mine just as quickly. But what do they say? The greatest courage in this life is to face the truth about ourselves, right? Yours truly included, distorted thinking. For several years, I worked as a Christian therapist in Oklahoma. And I kind of hesitate to say that because a lot of people, it was the Bible Belt, right? And there was some kind of religious organization almost every two blocks, even in a community of 10,000. And a lot of people, were in church and all of that. But I really, what I was really known as, I guess more than anything, was the Bible therapist. Now, that was kind of strange to me. It certainly wasn't something I started. But I guess that was because the Bible was always on my desk. And people knew that. And if they didn't want to work with the book, they just didn't come see me. Because if I can't use the Bible when I work in therapy, I don't have anything to say. Everything else really is a subjective call, correct? My opinion, that's where I would start, that's where I would end. I mean, that was it. They knew I would fight to save a relationship, but I would not enable or allow addictions, adultery, or abuse. They knew also that I didn't want to see him for 35 years. In other words, my job, as I saw it, was to work myself out of a job, to help them develop whatever tools, whatever they needed to correct in their life, and to send them on their way. Now, I say all that to say this. It was a community of 10,000, serviced about 100,000 people. It wasn't that large. I had the cream of the crop as my clientele, not because I wanted it, but the cream of the crop religiously. That's the point. I had a lot of different religious faiths that came to see me through the years. But everyone I saw came to me with a belief in God, a belief in Jesus as the Son of God, and a belief in the Bible as the Word of God. The bottom line, these were good people. These were good people. As they say, Bible-believing people going to some type of religious service, usually on Sunday. And this is the irony. It never ceased to amaze me the way Satan could mess with the gray matter of a good person that was really trying to do the right thing, and they would never even know it. Many times, never even recognize it when it was called to their attention. I didn't keep a running list through the years that would really, as far as reasons people would give for immoral behavior. I didn't have to, because the reasons I heard most often will be up here forever, right? But I'll share just a couple of categories with you this evening. So hopefully, sitting objectively, if I have sat for years, you could watch Satan work his lies and destruction. Remember, he's the father of distortion. Remember, the father of lies. All right, let's just call it. I think probably one of the first things, most common things I heard, you see on the screen, I'm just not happy. I'm just not happy in this relationship, and I'm God's child, and God loves me, and I have one life to live, and I deserve to be happy. He wants me to be happy. I don't even know if I love my spouse anymore. Oh, I guess I do, sort of. But we were so young when we married, I had no clue of what love through a lifetime, through decades, would look like. And bottom line, I'm just not liking this anymore. And I'm not happy, and I deserve that. And so I've decided to, or I have, and you fill in the blanks, because if you can imagine it, I probably heard it through the years. Now, keep in mind, I'm the Bible therapist, remember? You know where I'm headed with this. So after I would hear my client say that, I would look at them, and speaking with the client, just like I'm speaking to you right now, I would say, you know, that's a really interesting comment. I hear that a lot. I've studied this book a long time, and I've never been able to find the passage or the verse that says that my purpose in life is to be happy. Would you find it for me, please? And I handed them the book. I did not say another word until I was spoken to. I will not play defense. I am on offense 100% of the time. And I just sat there and smiled. I think the shortest time I waited was about 10 minutes. The longest time was 45 minutes, the remainder of the session. Occasionally they wanted to go home and do research and talk to somebody, find out what the Greek would say. I encouraged that, because the lesson I wanted to teach was well worth waiting to teach. Ladies and gentlemen, 100% of the time, I don't care if it would be moments later or weeks later, they sat in front of me, smiled rather sheepishly, and said, well, I thought it was in there, but I couldn't find it. That was my cue. At that point, I led them into a discussion about how the book says a lot about our purpose in life. And it really comes down to choosing a relationship with the one that put us here. And I'm not talking about biological parents. And choosing to reflect his love for us to each other. And we would look at many passages of scripture. And the Bible says a lot about a little word, joy, that comes from doing the right thing because it's the right thing to do. Right? That's how you can be joyful when your life is literally falling apart. And we would look at many other passages of Scripture. But ladies and gentlemen, what's very interesting to me is that the book does the way happy, the way we use it in our language, is not even in the book. Not the way we use it in our language. Occasionally it's translated blessed, right? But that's not the way we use it, is it? When we think about someone being happy, what are we referencing? Basically, what is going on in their life at that point in time, and that includes the weather, and it includes how people are treating me and my environment and everything that's going on around me at that moment in time, from politics to sports, and all of those things are filtering through my mental and my physical, right, and my spiritual health at that point in time. Did you see how many variables I just mentioned? What? 7, 8, something like that? And those things are constantly in flux, correct? They're constantly changing. They're static. They're all over the place. They're fluid. They're everywhere. They're constantly changing. Therefore, follow the equation. What I think will make me happy for now and forevermore in every way in a spouse at age 21, I guarantee you it's going to shuffle by the time I'm 35, at least some. And it's going to change again by the time I'm 47, 56, or if I live 69 or 78 or 84. And if I'm dependent upon another person to make me happy the way I'm defining happy at every moment in my life, there's a very high probability I'm going to go through a lot of relationships, illicit or not, in my lifetime. Ladies and gentlemen, do not make joy and happy synonyms. They are not. They are not. They're eons apart. Joy is like that current deep beneath the ocean surface. Happiness is the wave that would crash on the beach and then recede. They're very different.
Have you ever noticed the world of advertisement? That one of the hooks they put out there is, you're one product away from happiness. If you had this product, you'd be happy. Your friends would be happy. And as that renowned American scholar Phil Robinson says, happy, 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 happy. Oh, if Junior can get this gift on Christmas Day, he'll be happy. And he is happy for 30 minutes. Then he gets an argument with his brother over the box the toy came in. What's out at your never a garage sale? What you thought was going to make him happy. That's what Lynn said. Your definition of happiness at age 12 is not going to be the same as 24. And if you make a decision about whether or not you're going to get rid of this spouse where you are, there's a good possibility that you're going to hurt yourself and a lot of innocent people.
I heard many other reasons as well, and many of those also fell into a category. And so again, let me share the category, and we will go from there. You see on the screen, it's not my fault. We could refuse, we could rephrase that, refusal to accept responsibility for one's own actions. I can only speak for myself. I know that, and I'm well aware of the fact that many therapists have had different experiences. But I can honestly say from my experiences, and I'm old, my practice, now 22 years on the road, I have never had the following experience. I have never had someone sit in front of me and say, my wife is a good woman, or my husband is a good man, and I have decided to, or I have, you fill in the blank, and I accept total 100% responsibility. Personally, I have never heard that. Many times I have heard, my wife is a good woman, or my husband is a good man, but, and then the contingency statements would start. She shouldn't have gained those 5 pounds after those 8 children. She had no right. She knows I'm visually oriented. Did she honestly think I wasn't going to look the other way? Or he plays golf 3 times a year. Huh. How selfish can he be? If he thinks for 1 minute I'm going to sit around this house and wait on him, he can just think again. Well, I'm being a little facetious here, but I think you get the idea. Oh, they would readily many times admit that they had made a poor choice, but someone else was largely responsible for that. Sometimes it was a spouse. Sometimes it was the culture. Sometimes it was genetic. Sometimes it was something that had happened to them when they were very, very young. Ladies and gentlemen, if you heard us this afternoon, you're well aware of the fact that I am a strong proponent of what's called the pyramid of the personality and this accident of birth, right? That base of the pyramid. The early voices that rear us the first 3, 5, 7 years of life, and the genetics in our personality that are pre-wired into us the moment of conception. We're going to talk about that tomorrow night. Accident of birth, why? No one votes about genetics. No one votes about the early voices that rear us. And I'll be quite honest, some people were dealt some really rough blocks down here, genetically and with the early voices. Things that happened when they were young, helpless children that shouldn't have happened. But ladies and gentlemen, while we cannot help the things that happen to us when we're young like that, we are not jellyfish. We are people of reason and of a moral nature. We are responsible for what we choose to do with that as we grow. And even if we don't know why we keep sabotaging our lives and making bad choices, we are people of intellect. And certainly in this country, we have the ability to seek resources to help us figure it out. But not one time did I ever hear it. It was always, always someone else's fault. Ladies and gentlemen, we could probably sit here for a couple of hours and just give you case after case after case of distorted thinking. Obviously, we're not going to do that. I am going to share a few very specific scenarios just so you can really see how bizarre this gets. These are real life scenarios, and by the way, don't try to figure out who these people are because you'll never get there. We've been all over the map, remember? You would never get there. I am using church leaders, true stories, church leaders tonight, not because they are certainly any more significant than the rest of us, not at all. But it is our observation, and it's not fair, but it's right, when a church leader falls, the collateral damage is greater. It shouldn't be, but it is. And so that's why I'm calling from these examples of church leaders. Specifically, one elder having an affair, a married elder, with another elder's wife. He had three teenage children, boys. And he was in the process, he was contemplating divorcing his wife, right on the cusp of that. And I was working with him, trying to get him to see the irony in his thoughts, the distortion in his thinking, his reasoning, how all that was off. And I couldn't get through. And so finally I went to the children. And I was trying to get him to see the collateral damage for his children. And I'll never forget, he looked at me, and his kids were good, they're good boys. And he looked at me finally and he said, "Lynn, I know that my boys are good boys and that this is gonna mess them up. It's gonna hurt them. Because I will divorce their mother. I'm determined. And I will marry this other woman when her divorce is final. And then we'll just find another community of faith somewhere and go there. And I know it's going to mess them up. But Lynn, I want you to know one thing about me. I want you to know that I'm not like a lot of other people. I'm not. Because when my boys are messed up, I'm going to be there for them." And I just looked at him and I said, "Why don't you just get your act together and not mess them up to begin with?" But do you see the fallacy in the thinking? Do you see? That made perfect sense to him. This is what I'm talking about. This cognitive distortion. This is what Satan can do to people. Working with a deacon's wife, having an affair with a fellow deacon, not as the elder, that congregation, different church group, all right? But she was married, having an affair with a married deacon, same congregation. And this is what she said. "Lynn, my husband and I were having marital problems, and so we were going to marriage counseling. But I really thought that my lover needed equal time. And so for each hour I was going to marriage counseling with my husband, I was going to relationship counseling with my lover. And I just thought, beam me up, Scotty." It makes you crazy. And it made perfect sense to her. She just looked at me and smiled. I'll never forget one particular woman. This was way, way back, probably 30 years ago now. I was working with her, and she was a preacher's wife, having an affair with a married elder in a city 90 miles away. And I'll never forget what she told me. And she was going to divorce her husband. And I worked with her, and finally she looked at me and she said, "Lynn, you just don't understand me." She said, "You see, I am a person of such high moral nature. My moral compass is so strong that I just cannot stay married to my husband when I'm in love with another man." And I'll never forget, I'll never forget, you know that feeling you get in your stomach when you think you're going to be sick? And I felt I was literally going to be sick. And I remember thinking, "Okay, Lynn, for once in your life, shut your mouth. Don't say anything. Don't breathe audibly. Don't blink. Just sit perfectly still. And she will hear the fallacy of her thinking. And she just stared very blankly at me. And then I remember that wave that came over me of just total helplessness. And I thought, have we truly now become a culture where we can excuse our immorality with our morality? If so, God help us all. Ladies and gentlemen, listen carefully. We've been around the block a long time, for many years, and I say with 100% certainty, if a person wants to do something badly enough, they can convince themselves that it's God's will for their life. I don't care how many years they've been a Christian. I don't care how many years they've been a church leader or been in a religious atmosphere. One more time. If a person wants to do something badly enough, Satan will enable an individual to do enough mental gymnastics to twist everything around so they are convinced in their own mind that it is God's will for their life. Ladies and gentlemen, listen very carefully. If you're like any of the rest of us, there will be many times in your life that you cannot trust what you think. And you certainly can't trust what you feel. There's only one counter for distorted thinking. If at any point in your life, what you think you have to do, what you feel like you have to do, what you think you must do, if it goes against the book, you just don't do it. And that's the only counter. You must trust the Bible over emotion. End of argument. End of discussion. Satan is that powerful. He's going to play with every one of our minds. If at any point in your life, what you think you want to do, what you feel like you have to do, I don't care how badly you want to do something, if it goes against the book, you don't do it. There's an experience I'm told that pilot aircraft called spatial disorientation.
When I was getting training to become a private pilot, after...
Oh. When I get training to be a private pilot...
What would you do without me?
I'm not answering. I wouldn't do anything. I was training to be a private pilot a number of years ago, and I had to then take a flight test. And the instructor gets in the plane, and he's sitting next to you, or the person who's going to give you your license or not. And he then puts a hood over your head to fly on the instruments. In words, you can't see out. The man said, give me a medium bank turn to the left. I said, okay. So I gave him a medium bank turn to the left. He said, I said a medium bank turn to the left. He said, sir, that's what I'm doing. He said, what does that instrument tell you? Well, let's say a medium bank turn to the right. Well, how do you rationalize? How do you believe that? I said, well, that instrument happens to be wrong. He said, Mr. Jones, take your hood off. I took my hood off, and you know what? It was a medium bank turn to the right. We were in a little Cessna 150. He stuck his finger right in my face. He said, don't you ever do that again. You trust these instruments until you fly straight into the ground.
Don't forget the spiritual analogy. One more time, there will be many times in all of our lives that we are in a spiritual disorientation. What we think is right is really wrong. What we think is wrong is really right. Up is down. Down is up. One more time. Don't forget it. If at any point in your life, what you think you want to do, what you feel like you have to do, if it goes against the instrument, don't do it, or you'll fly your life right into the ground.
We're going to now proceed into what we call the anatomy of an affair. In other words, how does an affair actually take place? Now, really, there are basically three types of affairs, and we're only going to deal with one type tonight. The two that we're not going to deal with is, first of all, what we call the one-night stand. A person goes away, maybe on a business trip, makes a bad choice. They come back, their heart is broken, it's never repeated ever again. The second one would not deal with it, what we call the affairs of the true sex addict. These are multiple in nature. They span years. They span partners. And unless you're working with a mental illness, these affairs are spawned from deep, unmet emotional needs from childhood and the fear of emotional intimacy in adulthood. We will deal with some of this on Tuesday night. The affair that we will deal with tonight is the one that grows out of friendship, from emotional closeness. And on the surface, they look very innocent, but they're very lethal. We feel an audience of this size, even on a Sunday night, there are people in this room making some bad choices, and you don't even realize it. You don't even realize the danger that you're in. But it's our job now to give you a six-step model of how good people make bad choices. So we're going to ask every adult in this audience tonight to be honest with every relationship that's presently going on in your life. Maybe you don't think it's important. Maybe it's something you never told your spouse. Not that you're trying to hide something, but it just didn't think to be important. What we're sharing with you is a theory of attraction. A theory of attraction is something you learned in psychology class. It's how you became attracted to your present spouse. Now, theory of attraction is not wrong within itself, but you put it in the context of a marital situation, it becomes very dangerous. Something we taught you earlier today, sin distorts reality, sin distorts truth. And anything God makes good, Satan can make bad. And step number one. Step number one is attraction. Just because you wear a ring on your left hand does not mean you'll not be attracted to members of the opposite sex. There's blood that runs through your veins. Welcome to the human race. Now, the attraction might not just be physical. It might be personality. It might be chemistry. Well, we just didn't already click together. Now, you cannot help attraction from happening from time to time. But what you can help is what you do from that step forward. Step number two is proximity. Proximity says you're in the person's arena, maybe work arena, recreation, social, religious, neighbors. Did you not marry somebody you had access to, went to school with, same congregation, went to college with, grew up in the same neighborhood, worked at the same place? Now, you need to understand that these steps are not static. They flow basically one into another.
Step number three is interaction. And that's just a psychobabble word. All that means is that we're communicating. We are a social people, correct? And we communicate in all the arenas of our lives, certainly in the religious arena. We worship together, maybe small groups together, fellowship together, absolutely, classes together, retreats perhaps. Oh, and the vocational arena. Anyone that holds a job interacts with other people. And we must not forget the social arena. People that you know casually in your neighborhood, in your community. And as America becomes more and more health conscious, we have to mention the recreational arenas, the co-ed softball teams, tennis leagues, golf leagues, and the fitness center or the gym. Oh, my, the fitness centers. Yeah. Anyone that has ever worked out in a fitness center is very aware of the fact that the burn doesn't burn as badly if you talk to someone while you're burning. Now, we leave absolutely nothing to chance at this point. There are some very definite red flags at this juncture.
Number one would be anticipation. You get up in the morning and you know you're going to meet that individual. Maybe you're going to see him at the fitness center. Maybe you're going to see him at work. Maybe even at church. And I mean, you get up and you say, boy, this is going to be a very good day. Secondly is appearance. Because you're going to see that person, you try to put on things that make you look good, make you look sharp. You know, put on that aftershave lotion, guys. Brush a little cool water on. Smile.
Well, that's important.
Oh, you want to smile. You want to make sure when that person sees you, they say, boy, what'd it be like to be married to somebody like that that's so smiling and happy rather than this dud that I've got at home? And location. You find yourself manipulating things so you just happen to meet. Pick up the mail the same time. Pick up the children same time. Walk the dog same time. Copy machine, same break, same restaurant, same Bible class, same small group maybe even. Attaboy, Jonesy, I knew there's something wrong with those small groups all along. That's why I'm not a part of them, just a bunch of people getting together having affairs. That's what it is. All right, you ready to get serious with me? Is there a member of the opposite sex, not your spouse, that you love to see them? You find yourself dressing sharp when you see them. And you find yourself manipulating things so you happen to see one another. I'm telling you, you're going down the wrong road as fast as you can.
The next step is disclosure. Step number four. Sometimes it's called self-disclosure. And it occurs when the interaction goes beyond the casual interchange and progresses to the point where one of the individuals begins disclosing personal things about himself or herself to the other. This is the beginning of an emotional bond, because usually this involves issues with the marriage, maybe issues or problems with a spouse. And the self-talk in one's mind that would actually precede the disclosure itself might sound a little bit like this.
You know, my wife and I were having a hard time getting along. We can't communicate anymore. She shouts at me, and I just shout back at her. She pouts. And I don't know how much longer I can go on this way. I need some help. But who could help me? It takes a woman probably to help. But who could help me? Ooh, I remember last year we went on a vacation down to Florida, and this other couple's with us, and they're at church, and they have a great marriage. Everybody knows that. And she talks about all the people she's helped and encouraged. I thought, well, maybe I need to get on your list. I think I'll just give her a call. She knows me and knows my wife. That's what Christians are for anyway, you know, to help one another. I'm going to be a little embarrassed to tell her some things, but I've got to have some help.
I don't know what's wrong with my marriage. I love my husband. That's not it. He just doesn't have time for me. He's busy, you see. All he has time for sports, his friends, his job, his hobbies. He just doesn't have time for me. I tell him I'm lonely. He tells me to quit complaining. I'm glad I have my job. I love my job. The hours at work are so much nicer than the hours here at home. My boss is a great guy. He always has time for me. He listens. He asks questions. He's attentive. He's affirming. He's offered to help any of us in the office with problems. I'm not sure he meant marital problems. But then maybe he did. He really seems to have a good marriage. I've met his wife. She's a nice woman. Be great married to a guy like that. Maybe he could help me a little bit. Give me some insight into my husband's thinking. Don't look at me that way. Everybody deserves somebody. All I want is a little male attention. I deserve that. My husband doesn't want the job. My boss is a nice man. He likes me. Maybe he can give me some ideas on what my husband's thinking. But you know, I really don't care if he can or not, because I like him, and I like his company. Disclosure. The next step is equity. It occurs after disclosure with one or two responses. Initially, the person who has been disclosed to validates the discloser. Did you get all those disclosing words? The person who has been disclosed to validates the discloser. Statements like, that's awful. I don't know why you put up with that. You shouldn't live in that. You deserve better. I wouldn't treat you that way. Those kinds of statements come forth. And or the person who has been disclosed to begins disclosing back problems with his or her marriage, problems with his or her spouse. And at this point, an emotional bond is formed. And equity, after it has transpired for just a very short period of time, might sound a little bit like this.
Lynn, I really enjoy these times together. You have just been really my salvation. I mean, you're so talented, and I feel so comfortable in every way. You're the most positive thing going on in my life, and you've been able to help me so much to realize that I'm not as bad a person as my wife thinks I am. And so these couple times we've met have been helpful. But what really blew my mind is after we met two or three times, you began telling me that your marriage is not everything that you would like for it to be, and nobody in church would even know that. So maybe I've been a help to you, because that's what Christians are, to help one another.
You're a good man. You're a good friend. I really appreciate who you are, what you are, how you've been helpful to me. Your wife is really a lucky woman, you know. She doesn't know what she has. As equity progresses, you become a better friend to this person than you are to your own spouse. Clinically, it's called emotional adultery. So let's call it, shall we? Emotional adultery. You are now a better friend to this person, than you are to your own spouse.
If you feel there's a member of the opposite sex better understands you than your spouse does, you're in trouble. If you find yourself fantasizing during the daytime of what it would be like to marry to them rather than the one you're presently married to, you are in double trouble.
Step six is a step that breaks the heart, many times severs the marriage, and appears on the divorce decree. But ladies and gentlemen, it is just a very small step from step five, emotional adultery, to step six, physical adultery. You didn't mean it. You love your spouse. You just wanted someone to eat lunch with, someone to take a coffee break with, share a few jokes with, counsel with. They were having issues. They needed good advice. Study the Bible with. They needed God in their life. What happened? Satan, the father of lies and distortions, took something that was fine when you weren't married and your spouse wasn't either, and now has moved it into the marital arena, has distorted it, and has created something incredibly destructive. Ladies and gentlemen, there is just one counter.
2 Timothy 2 and verse 22, the young preacher's told, flee immorality. Run the other way as fast as you can go. You say, well, I know how far I can go, and I'm not going to step over those boundaries. There's a possibility you've already compromised what you said you wouldn't do. If what you're doing is not wrong, let's make a video of it, CD of it, DVD, I should say, and let's put it on the screen for everybody to see. Now, if you're not willing to do that, then something somewhere is wrong. We can convince you that the direction you're going is the wrong direction, but you're going to have to make some choices. You're going to have to make some maybe radical changes. No more emails, no more cell phone, no more text messages, no more chance meetings. It's over. You might have to change jobs. You might have to change churches. You might have to change where you live. My question is, what's your marriage worth? What's your marriage worth? One thing that we have observed, this is not true of all the affairs we've dealt with, but many times in an affair situation, the other spouse knew the person. Let's say the man had the affair. We've had it many times say that his wife said, well, I knew that person, and I thought she was my best friend. That's why, ladies and gentlemen, even among Christian people, Christian couples, there are boundaries that need to be drawn over which you will not cross.
Right.
You say, well, you're paranoid. I'm not paranoid, folks. I'm getting sick and tired of dealing with this stuff. Now, that's about as plain as I can make it. But this is what we're finding, and this is what's going on. Genesis chapter 39, story of Joseph. Verse 6, now Joseph was well-built and handsome. What did Potiphar's wife do?
What did she say? Come to bed with me. That's pretty plain. He said, no. How can I do such a wicked thing and sin against God? Though she spoke to Joseph day after day, he refused to go to bed with her or even be with her. Good idea. I'm out of your arena, lady. One day he went to his house to attend to his duties. None of the household servants were inside. She caught him by his cloak and said, come to bed with me. But he left his cloak in her hand and ran out of the house. Ran, R-A-N, not to be confused with skip or walk. I suggest you follow Joseph in that area. Ounce of prevention. We're going to give you some things that I believe will be very helpful to you. Number one, there's safety in numbers. Two is company, and three, security. Do not get yourself alone with members of the opposite sex for extended periods of time. We're talking about carpools. We're talking about sometimes even work assignments. Now, sometimes you have to be involved with members of the opposite sex in a worker situation. But you make sure that the conversation is on the work and on the business. It doesn't spill over into personal life things.
Absolutely.
Now, that's the rule. Gentlemen, when that lady says, well, you're the only one that can help me, don't buy it.
No, she's shopping.
Don't buy it at all.
She is.
Now, we believe the 24-7 rule. You ought to be able to share with your spouse what you do 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, including cell phones, text messages, email accounts, or whatever it is. Anytime a person will not make these things available to their spouse, even if they don't even ask, we're making them available. We're saying you're hiding something that's not right. And in our day, folks, this is happening. People get on Facebook, they get on other pages, find somebody they went to high school with or whatever, and here we go. Folks, this is the real world, and this is what's going on. Somebody asks you to counsel with them, say, look, I'm not a professional counselor. We got somebody down at church. We'd be glad to recommend to you.
Or perhaps, gentlemen, if a woman does say, I need you to help me with this, I think probably your best response is, you know, my wife is really good with this kind of thing. Let's see what she thinks. That'll cut it right there. And ladies, vice versa. But gentlemen, ask you, my husband's really knowledgeable. That won't last very long. And by the way, we are working more and more with internet affairs. And many times, most often, they do come, at least the ones that have crossed our path, with recreating with old high school or college flames. Be very careful, because the internet affairs follow almost step by step the issue, the pattern that we have just outlined for you, except the proximity is not face to face until a little bit later. But the disclosure is the same, the equity is the same, until finally the meeting is the same. Is the combination. Be wise. Just be wise, because Satan will find a really small crack in an area that you think is not important, but he will make it very, very significant. Next, you see here a hug or a hug. And you can see, by the way, the words are written, there is a difference. I myself am a hugger. I love touch, but there's a correct way to do that, an incorrect way. With a member of the opposite sex, ladies, you probably know how all this works. But gentlemen, in case you do not, let me explain it to you. Generally speaking, with a member of the opposite sex, a loose front hug, it's called an A-frame hug, by the way, all right? Or a loose side hug with an elbow appropriately placed would be fine. A tight front hug or a tight side hug is almost always inappropriate. I am not questioning your integrity. What I am saying is perception is reality. And you never know how what you think is an innocent gesture is being perceived by someone else. Some people can write entire romantic scenarios around something that you didn't think anything about at all. Just be wise. Just be wise. Just like many of you, I've worked in the secular work world. It never ceased to amaze me, the games that married people play with married people, single people, anybody that'll play. It's nothing more than junior high flirting. The subtle eye contact, the stolen glances, double meanings of words, shared jokes, innuendos, junior high flirting. Some people even flirt to the extent that they have others as imaginary conquests. Oh, they don't sleep around, but in their mind, if they wanted to do that, they have a huge smorgasbord from which to choose. Actually, psychologically, that's very unhealthy, probably indicative of one of two things. Either the person is that narcissistic or conceited and think they're that wonderful and desirable, or they have a really poor self-esteem and they're using other people to bolster that. Either way, you want no part of that. Occasionally, someone will come and we'll be talking and they'll say, well, members of the opposite sex are always hitting on me, coming on to me. Now, I am not in the blame the victim thing. I'm not. But I must admit, in these particular situations, depending on how this individual is coming across to me, occasionally I will ask this person, is there a possibility that you are sending messages that you're a player? Some people don't play, but you would never know it by the way they talk, by the way they dress, and by the way they handle their body language. I don't know about you, but I have seen as much cleavage as I care to see. Thank you. I don't care how beautiful you are or how handsome you might be. It makes no difference. There is a way you cut your eyes. There's an inflection you put in your voice. And there is a way you handle your body language, and it says without saying one word, I don't play. Don't even think about it. I don't play. It is not rude, but it is firm. And let me tell you, it is never, never misunderstood. And by the way, gentlemen, women know women. We know women. You know, we've got antenna going on all the time. We do. Beep, 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 beep! If your wife says there is a female that is too attentive to you, you do not argue. You do not negate her. You do not rebuttal. You say, yes, ma'am. And you establish those boundaries, because she knows exactly what she's talking about. And ladies, if your husband says that there is a gentleman that's too attentive to you, you already know about it, so just cut it out, all right?
Okay.
Enough said.
Yeah, and moving on to the next point. We believe you need to do an I do every day. I do every day. Every day, this woman is told how much I love and appreciate her, because I do. She is one magnificent person. I'm trying to brag on her all the time. Very seldom, if ever, do we ever part, maybe I've got to go run an errand, that we do not exchange, I love you. Very seldom. There's probably a reason why I think that's important. Because I know someday I'll tell her I love you for the last time. And I want her to know that the last thing I ever said to her was, I love you.
I can't remember to do it.
No excuse. Write it on your hand. Doesn't come naturally. Do it till it does. Let me tell you the counseling appointment we've never had. We've never had a woman come up to us and say, I need some counseling. I've got a husband who tells me about 25 times a day how much he loves and appreciates me, and I'm getting sick and tired of hearing, how in the world do I shut the old coot up? If that's your problem, we will make you
tell us
famous.
We'll talk
yeah,
about
we'll
you.
Talk about you
in sure a good way. And finally, as we conclude this session, flying solo, kind of an odd topic, isn't it? In an ideal world, if it were ideal, and if you are married, your spouse is as intent as you are in being the man or woman of God that he or she's been called to be, correct? As Jerry's already indicated, the closer you get to the Creator, what happens? You're going to get closer together. But it's far from ideal, isn't it? It is. Far from ideal. And in a crowd this size, we're very aware of the fact that some of you are flying solo. Oh, you're married. Oh, yeah. But you see, there are issues in the marriage. And the spouse won't even acknowledge them, much less work on them. And so you're flying solo emotionally, maybe even spiritually. Now, before I end this session, or we do, I've got to put in a little disclaimer. From this point forward to the end of this session, we are only talking about emotional estrangement. Everybody get that? We are not, underscore not, talking about addictions, adultery, or abuse. We shy away from nothing. We'll hit that tomorrow night. Don't worry. All right? But from this point forward, in this session, we are only talking about emotional estrangement. Initially, if you find yourself in this particular situation, acknowledge the fact that it is not your job to change your spouse or make him or her holy. I think one very popular author says, you are not your spouse's personal Holy Spirit. Well put. I assume if you've been married any length of time at all, the arguments have been made. Maybe the tears have been shed. You've begged, you've pleaded, you've ignored, you've done everything. I would then implore you to quit going over the same things over and over again and making everybody miserable. I would. Your spouse knows how important this is to you. You continue to pray, but instead of speaking those words, I would leave you with what I believe is very wise advice from Albert Schweitzer. And I quote, I have decided at last to let my life be my argument. I have decided at last to let my life be my argument, because it speaks much louder anyway. And finally, make God your spouse. I'll never forget the first time that I heard that. I was a very young woman, 23 years old, Tulsa, Oklahoma, been married 3 years, women's retreat. I don't remember the woman's name. I don't remember anything else she said but this. She said, now ladies, if you find yourselves in a marriage and you're emotionally estranged from your husband and your husband just won't pay any attention, he won't help, he won't work on anything, you must make God your spouse. At age 23, I thought that was the most ridiculous thing I had ever heard in my life. How did anybody ever do that? And I dismissed it. Not 23 anymore. Been around the block lots of times. And I'll be quite honest, Jerry and I have been blessed hundreds of times over by coming in contact with these people. They're beautiful people. They have a peace and a joy that really belies understanding or logic in any way. I'm told it comes with a heart cry, not even a prayer, that God will enable us to stop thinking about what we're not getting and to do what's right because it's right. We're so caught into reciprocity, aren't we? I'll do this, you do this, I'll do this. No, I'm not doing anything else because you owe me. The score is 5-7. Forget that stuff. Forget that stuff. You will do what's right because it's right, not because what is coming back to you in return. That is true agape love, that kind of love. It's amazing when you really want that to happen, you will have a peace and a calm and a joy that you probably at this point don't think is ever attainable. Let me speak quite frankly here for just a few moments, and then we will let you go. And I will say, before I even begin, I do not know your stories. And if what I'm about to say hurts anybody's feelings, I apologize ahead of time. I would not hurt you for the world. I would not. But these words that I'm about to say are not geared at those among us who have already made choices. These are aimed at those among us who still have choices to make. If you are sitting there tonight thinking about ending your marriage because you are emotionally estranged, you are probably on the verge of making the greatest mistake of your life. You think you've known pain. I'll tell you quite honestly, you haven't begun to taste it yet. You haven't. Instead of getting to that point when you can sign that decree and you say, now I'm free, I can find my true match, I want you to roll the clock forward in the calendar and the years in real time. And I want you to look at your life as it's really going to look. If you have young children, I want you to imagine meeting your now spouse, the other parent, at McDonald's parking lot on Christmas Day at noon. The trade children. Because that's going to happen. It never ceases to amaze me when people are so emotionally hurt and they want to hurt this spouse that they perceive all this is coming from, that they assume if they divorce this person, this individual will huddle in the fetal position in a corner for the rest of their lives and mourn their lives away. That will not happen. Your spouse will remarry. And you know what? Unless there is an exception, that spouse, that new spouse, will have 50% access to your children. Ladies, are you really willing for another woman to have your children 50% of the time? Okay. But go into it with your eyes wide open. Gentlemen, are you ready for another man to have access to your children 50% of the time? That's going to happen. That's going to happen. I want you to think about it. Think about it. Or if they're older, I want you to think about the times that should be the happiest times in their lives, the graduations and the weddings and the holidays. And instead of times of celebration, it's a time of anxiety and nervousness and relief when it's all over. Because where do you put mom and where do you put dad? And they don't want to see each other. And how much time do you spend with each one? And what about the step people? And what do you call them anyway? Or like one young man told us, oh, 3-4 years ago now, about this time of year, after this session, a big old hulk of a guy came down. I was by myself up front, tears streaming down his face, and about 2 steps behind him was his wife carrying a 4-month-old little girl. And he said, don't ever stop saying what you're saying. You see, my parents are divorced, and my wife's parents are divorced, and they've all remarried. And so we spent the holidays, 7 days, going around from different homes trying to introduce our new daughter to her grandparents. And when we arrived home, everyone was mad at us. Why? Because somebody had to delay their dinner. Someone didn't open presents when they wanted to. We were with one set of parents 30 minutes more than another set, or with one set on a day than that they didn't want. And we were exhausted, and we had tried so hard. And we cried, and we prayed, and we made a very, very tough decision. But we're standing by it. We called all of our parents, and we assured them of our love and that they were welcome in our home at any time. But we told them from this point forward, we would celebrate the holidays, the birthdays, the special days by ourselves, with the two of us and any other children that we might have, that we refuse to be puppeted around for the rest of our lives by their choices. And you can only imagine, at this point, I was crying too. And all I could do was reach up and hug his neck and say, Godspeed to you. Godspeed to you. Do it better. One more time. If you're sitting there tonight thinking about ending your marriage because you're emotionally estranged, I beg you, I would plead with you one-on-one if you would give me half a chance. Instead of that, remember those wise words of that woman so many decades ago. I don't even remember her name now, but praise God, she walked this earth. God will enable you to do what you don't think you can do. He'll enable you to stop thinking about yourself and to do what's right, because it's right. Die old with honor. Die old unselfishly. Die old with integrity. Mark my words. As you look back over the years of your life, you won't be sorry that you did.
Tomorrow night, please listen to me. You're visiting with us tonight. You're not a part of this church. We are our honored guests. We thank you very much for coming. Look around and maybe see somebody that you know is not here. Get on the phone tonight or tomorrow. Get them to back here. I guarantee
fight
you.
Fight night tomorrow night.
No, we're not going to fight.
Yeah, we are.
Okay,
tomorrow
we'll
night.
Fight tomorrow night. Okay. We'll have it. Thank you very much. Good night and God bless.